Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore. Thank you so much for coming this evening, and thank you for supporting independent bookstores. We really appreciate that, and for supporting our author programs. And tonight, we have a special treat, Justin Halperin, who wrote Shit My Dad Says, which I could counter with Shit My Mother Says, but anyway, we'll talk later. And his new book, I Suck at Girls. So I just want to give him all the time, so please welcome Justin Halperin.
Thanks, everybody, for coming, first of all, and thanks for Tattered for having this event. This is by far the coolest bookstore that I've been to. It's not like a soulless Barnes & Noble where they stick me in the corner and random people show up. Who are you? Which you'd be surprised happens a lot at book readings. All right, so I figured I'd do a little reading first, read a chapter first, and then talk a little bit and answer any questions you guys have and sign. So, and thank you again for coming out. It means a lot to me to do these events and see people come out. It's really cool. It's nothing I ever dreamed would happen. So, I'm always trying to look for like the lesser of the embarrassing stories. I know. I did an event 2 days ago, and they hosted it at my high school, and they were like, read this. They're like, read the story about losing your virginity. I'm like, no. No, I'm not gonna read that one. When you write these things, you're like by yourself, and you don't think anybody's gonna read them. And then when you have to do readings and look at people in the eyes and say stuff, it's way more embarrassing. That said, I'm going to read When You're Married, Your Wife Sees Your Penis. When I was little, my two favorite things were Cinnamon Toast Crunch cereal and learning new words. I was obsessed with expanding my vocabulary. Every time I heard a word I didn't recognize, I'd ask the nearest adult what it meant. No one had a more extensive vocabulary than my father, who spent a lot of time reading with me each night to indulge my thirst for language. My teacher said, "Someday I'm going to know as many words as you do," I told him one night as we sat at the dinner table after I aced an oral test in my third grade English class. "Don't take this the wrong way, but your teacher's full of dog shit. I practice medicine, which opens up my vocabulary to thousands of words you will never encounter. I know 100 goddamn ways to talk about blood vessels," he said, grabbing a bowl full of green beans and spooning a few onto his plate. "That's really cool," I said. "It's not cool. Makes my head want to explode. It's like a garage filled with useless shit. It ain't how many words you know, it's how you use them." A couple days after that conversation, my dad was appointed head of his department, nuclear medicine, at the University of California, San Diego. "So now you're the boss," I said when he told my family the news over spaghetti dinner. I looked at my mom, expecting her to be excited, but she just looked tense and unhappy. "Being the boss ain't always a good thing," my dad said as he took a sip of red wine. "Why not?" I asked. "You like playing baseball, right?" "Yeah." "Well, what if coach quit one day and they made you coach because no one else wanted to do it? So you have to coach a team, and instead of being able to play, you just have to sit and do all the bullshit that comes with coaching." "But coach likes being coach. It's because he's an asshole who's trying to live out his dreams for that kid of his who's 5 years away from a fucking heroin addiction because his dad's a psycho." "Sam, you know he's going to repeat that," my mom said. "Don't repeat that," he said to me. Anyway, my point is, I became a doctor to practice medicine and help people. Now I gotta sit in an office and do paperwork. It's not your problem, just means you're not gonna see a lot of me. After that, my dad started leaving for work before I woke up and arriving back home after 9 p.m. He worked a full day most Saturdays, too. Sunday was his only day off, but even then he went into the office. Nevertheless, no matter how late it was when he walked through our front door, or how tired he was, he would grab my favorite book, J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit, and call me into the living room, flip on a lamp next to our brown fabric couch, sit down right next to me, where he'd read to me or I'd read to him. Whenever I encountered a word I didn't understand, I'd stop and ask him what it meant. One night, while I was reading to him, he started laughing. "This might just be because I'm tired as hell, but you know what I just realized?" he asked. "What?" "Nobody ever gets laid in these Hobbit books." "Thing spans Bilbo's whole goddamn life. Guy never gets laid, not once, no sex," he said. "Well, Bilbo doesn't have any kids," I said. "What does that have to do with anything?" he asked. "Well, if he had sex, then he'd have kids." My dad let out a huge, long belly laugh. "Jesus Christ, thank God it doesn't work like that. I'd have populated half of fucking Rhode Island." I didn't understand why my dad was laughing, and I was insulted at his mockery. "You get married, and then if you want, you have sex and have kids," I said firmly. "If you want?" "Shit, don't tell your mother that, or I'd never get laid." "I don't think you know what marriage means," he said, laughing. "I know what it means. It's like a first grade word. I've known what it means for a long time," I scoffed. "I'm fairly certain you haven't the faintest goddamn clue, trust me," he replied. "Fine, then tell me what it means," I demanded. "Son, I just worked 15 hours, I'm dog tired, and you don't have a single hair on your balls. I think the conversation could wait until one of those things changes." The next day at school, as I sat in the cafeteria unpacking my lunch, I told my best friend Aaron what my dad had said about sex and marriage and asked him what he knew about the relationship between the two. A slender kid with shaggy brown hair and pasty white skin, Aaron grew up a few blocks from me. He had HBO, which instantly made him an expert about sex as far as I was concerned. He put down his Cheetos and wiped his hands on his University of Michigan Fab Five basketball t-shirt. "I can't believe you don't know this," Aaron said. On the night you get married, you get to have sex. Otherwise, it doesn't count as getting married. It has nothing to do with babies," he added. I already knew it didn't count unless you had sex. I already knew that," I lied. "Well, you're supposed to start kissing your wife, and then she takes your penis and she puts it in her, and you have sex," he said. "Does she see your penis?" I asked, panic creeping into my chest. No. "They just put their hand down there and grab it, but they can't look at it and see it unless you tell them that they can," Aaron answered. I'm not sure if it was an adverse reaction to the fact that my dad often walked around our house in the nude like a Playboy playmate in Hefner's mansion, or if it was just I was just self-conscious about my body. But there was nothing I hated more than the thought of someone seeing me naked. Not skinning my knees, not pooping in public restrooms, nothing. My brothers were usually my go-to for information, and even though they almost always made up ridiculous answers to my questions in an effort to make me look stupid, I still went back to the well time after time. One Sunday morning over breakfast, I asked them about the wedding night ritual. My brother Dan, who was well acquainted with my fear of nudity, was the first to weigh in. "There's a little bit more to it than that," he said. "Basically, you stand in one corner of the room, and she stands in the other. You each take off one piece of clothing at a time, and pants and underwear go first," he said. "Before shoes and socks?" I asked. "Yep. You still have your wedding tuxedo on. You're just not wearing pants or underwear," he said, biting into a chocolate glazed donut. This was troubling information. As soon as breakfast was over, I got up from the kitchen table and went into my bedroom, and I closed the door behind me. Then I put on the only suit I owned and proceeded to remove my pants and underwear, keeping on my shoes and socks and everything from the waist up. Then I looked into the mirror. Of all the disturbing images I'd encountered to that point in my life, that image of my skinny, half-naked body landed somewhere between when this weird kid Andre in my class turned his eyelids inside out and seeing a car run over the head of my neighbor's cat. I couldn't stand the idea of someone else seeing me in this compromising position and laughing uncontrollably, which I was sure they would. But before I took a vow to be a bachelor for life, there was one thing left to do. Ask the only person I knew who was married, always honest with me, and never mocked my fears, my mom. I changed out of my suit, threw on my Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle pajamas, and ran to my parents' room and knocked on the door. There was no answer, and the door was locked. I was fairly sure they were in there, but then again, they could have left before I woke up. I went back into the kitchen where my brother Dan was now working on a big bowl of Cinnamon Toast Crunch. Do you know if Mom is here? Her door is locked and nobody said anything when I knocked, I said. That her bedroom door is locked? Yeah. Just get a screwdriver and pop it open and see if they're in there. If they're sleeping, they'll probably want to be woken up so they won't sleep in too late. You know how Dad hates that, he replied. I should have sensed something was wrong given my brother's surprisingly helpful response. But he had a point. My dad did hate sleeping in, and rarely if ever did it. Armed with that reminder, and still panicked at the prospect of my future wife seeing me in half a tuxedo, I ran to the garage and grabbed a screwdriver from my dad's toolbox. The locks in our house were pop locks, easily opened by shoving a flathead screwdriver inside a tiny hole and turning. And so I did. When I opened the door, I saw my mom and dad naked in bed together, one big entangled mess of middle-aged limbs and hair. Until that moment, I didn't know what sex looked like, but I knew immediately that this was it. They both turned and looked at me and froze. "I'm sorry," I screamed. I slammed the door, ran down the hall, and sought refuge in my bedroom. About 5 minutes later, my dad opened my door, wearing a black terry cloth robe, his face contorted in the expression you make between the moment when you stub your toe and the moment you say, "ow." "Your mom wants me to sit down and tell you what you just saw, but I'm currently not in the mood to give a shit, due to be thrown out of my bed because my 8-year-old suddenly turned into Harry fucking Houdini." We stared at each other blankly, each waiting for me to say something. I was still in shock. "Well, I'm up, and my morning just took a left turn into a pile of shit, so you might as well tell me what has you picking my lock," he finally said. I hurriedly explained to him my fears about wedding nights and sex and nakedness and the humiliation of having to wear socks and shoes and no pants but pants and underwear. "You do realize the irony in this situation, right?" he asked. "What's irony mean?" "You want to know about married people screwing and then walk in with, no, you know what? You're not backdooring me into a conversation about this shit." He ran his fingers through his hair and blew a deep breath out through his nose. "All right, here's the deal. You're 8, he said. "I'm 9, I said. "Do I look like you carry an abacus with your name on it? Come with some slack here, son." He took another deep breath and started over. "What I'm trying to say is you're just a little kid. I'm going to make you a promise. On your wedding night, you're not going to be able to wait until your wife sees your penis. Half a tuxedo on, no tuxedo on, socks, shoes, you won't fucking care." "Well, how can you be sure?" I asked. "Trust me. You're going to be staring at your watch, wondering when this wedding's going to be over and all these people will go on their merry fucking way so that your wife can see your penis." "I will?" I asked, starting to feel comforted. "Yep. And if you're still afraid that your wife's going to see your penis, that means she ain't the one for you. It also means you got a bunch of fucked up issues and I totally screwed up and then I'll pay for therapy if I have the money, but I probably won't." "Anyway, for now, here's what the word marriage means. Don't pick the lock on my bedroom door on Sundays." He got up, padded down the hallway, and locked his bedroom door behind him. Thank you. That was actually one of the first stories I wrote for this book proposal when I was, after I'd finished Shit My Dad Says, right after I'd finished it and it started to do well, and the publisher immediately came back and was like, "Oh, do Shit My Dad Says Holidays." Like, they just throw stuff out. They don't know if you have anything to put there. I was like, "I don't have any holiday stories. We don't celebrate anything." Because my dad's an atheist and my mom grew up Catholic, but just doesn't really celebrate anything. And so I didn't really have an idea for a second book, and I didn't want to just throw something out there, because if you do that, A, it's going to be terrible. And then everyone who liked your first book and you've earned a little bit of their trust, then they come and they read this pile of crap you just wrote and they hate you. And the internet is all over the place now and you can't get away from people that hate you. So I didn't have any ideas of what to do. And I didn't have any plans to do it either. I was in the midst of writing a pretty crappy television show that was keeping me pretty busy. And so it was like maybe 6 months later, I decided I was going to propose to my wife, and I went and I bought a ring. And I hadn't told anybody. And I started to get more and more nervous the closer I got to when I wanted to propose, as I think most people do. And so I was like, you know what, I just want to tell somebody before I do it. And so I for some reason chose my dad, and I took him out to lunch, and I said, I'm super nervous, and I pull him aside, and I say, all right, I'm going to propose to Amanda, you know, and I was like, weight lifted off my shoulders. I finally said the words out loud, you know, and he goes, good for you. I'm going to have the romaine and watercress salad. And I was like, okay, good, but did you hear the first thing that I said before you ordered? He was like, yeah. He basically goes in, he goes, listen, if you were going to tell somebody that you wanted to get really excited about it, why would you have picked me? When have you ever seen me excited? And I remember I go, well, you were really excited when we won our Little League, when I won the Little League Championship. He's like, that was a sporting event. It's different. So he goes, I tell you what you should do. You should take a day. Here's what I did before I married your mom. He goes, you should take a day and go to the park. And this is what I did. I went to the park. He's like, I smoked a lot of weed, which I didn't know. I just thought about all my relationships that I had been in, you know. And then at the end of the day, I, you know, took stock and decided whether or not I still wanted to propose to your mother. He's like, and I did. So I suggest you do that. And so I did. And I didn't smoke any weed, but I did go to the park. And so at the end of that day, two things occurred to me. One, the first, most important, was that I wanted to propose still, and I felt pretty confident about it. And then the other was, you know, I have a lot of stories that might make a book that could be interesting to people. Because I always thought there's like a lot of books on one end that are like Tucker Max and The Game and like all this stuff where it's like these sort of misogynistic male bravado bullshit about like, oh, I had a one-night stand and I was like, get out of my bed, you skank. And it's like, I didn't know any dudes like that. We were all so grateful someone would sleep with us. Anytime a woman slept with me, it was like a gift. And there was no way I was being anything. I was like, I can make you breakfast. I'll pay for your gas. Like, what? Like, you know, I wanted to make sure they left happy. It was like Holiday Inn. I wanted, like, so, you know, so it was all that spectrum. And then on the other side, there was like these harrowing accounts of like these kids who were total social outcasts who really like battled a ton of things just to like have a normal life. And you know, I didn't think that there was a lot of stuff in the middle for most everyone else. And so, you know, I thought, you know, if I can write a book that people can sort of read these things and they're sort of universal stories that we all kind of remember, and it makes you guys talk about these things that happen in your life, the first, you know, walking in on your parents having sex, your first kiss, losing your virginity, things like that, and I'm just sort of like a vessel for that, then it could be a book that could be successful if it's funny. And it also has, I have the benefit of having a crazy, unique father. So that's what I tried to do. And I think, you know, it's one of those things where, like, I would say, like, I love David Sedaris. I think he's, like, amazing. He's just such a brilliant writer. But he's so interesting that I can read him doing anything because he's just, like, such an interesting guy. He'll write about a story he walked and mailed something at the post office. I'm like, that was amazing. And I'm just not that interesting of a guy. Like, I'm sort of just an every dude, and nobody wants to read about me going to the post office. But I think what that also allows me to do is that, you know, a lot of people can relate to the things that have gone on in my life because you guys probably have stories that are better than the stories that I have, you know, but it reminds you of them. So that's what I really wanted to do. And it's funny because, well, I'll tell you a quick story about my dad really quick, but I promise it's interesting. So, you know, I think that a lot of times, you know, I like to write about relationships in my life, and I think that your perspective you see different things from different relationships. Like you have a relationship with your dad or your mom, and you view it one way and they view it another way. And so I think it's interesting to see things from a couple different perspectives. And one of the things that really shaped my writing, I remember, is I was like 18, and my dad and I had just not been getting along for the last 18 years. Maybe. he was just you've probably read some of the stuff about him. He's a blunt guy, and I was a skinny, kind of not super confident kid, and that's a tough mix. And so when I was about to go off to college, we weren't talking a lot. And my mom was worried that our relationship was going to dissolve. And he comes into my room one day as I'm looking at a schedule. I'm got into San Diego State University. I'm looking at the classes. He walks in. He just like bursts in and he's like, your mom thinks of you hate me, and that we're not going to talk again until I'm 90. I got a load of shit in my pants and I'm dying. He's like, that's not true, right? Which is just a lot to throw at me to process. Like, all right, you're 90. What's happening? You're senile. So he goes, I'm going to tell you a story about me and my dad. He's like, I was 10 years old, and he grew up on a farm in Kentucky. He was a tobacco farmer, sharecropper. And he's like, I'm 10 years old, and I'm riding on this tobacco wagon, and I fall off the wagon. And the wagon wheel runs over my arm, and it crushes the bones in my elbow. And bones are sticking out of my arm, and I'm almost passing out on account of the pain. The pain's so bad. And I remember I go, oh, yeah, I totally know that. He's like, no, you don't. You don't know that. You have never known that. Stop talking. He's like, so they rushed me. This is Burlington, Kentucky, and this is 1946, and it's not exactly doctor's office around, so they rushed me 45 minutes to the nearest hospital. And by that time, infection started to take, they think. They're not sure. And my dad comes, and the doctor's there, and I'm laying in the hospital bed, and the doctor says to my dad, he says, there might be an infection taking hold in his arm. And we got two options. We can either amputate the arm at the elbow, and there's a 100% chance he'll live a full, healthy life. He'll just be missing part of his arm. And or we can inject some medicine into his arm every 2 hours for 2 weeks, and there's probably like a 40-60 chance that he lives, but he'll keep his arm. But the overwhelming odds are that he'll probably die. And so my dad's like, it's quiet, and grandpa's not saying shit, and the doctor's not saying shit, and I'm just sitting in the bed. He's like, and I'm waiting to hear what they say. The doctor said, and my grandpa, he says, and then grandpa says, give him the shots. And my dad, and the doctor says to grandpa, he says, but didn't you hear what I said? And there's a, chances are he'll die. And it's quiet again, and then grandpa says, then let him die. There's no room in this world for a one-armed farmer. So I hear that story, right? I'm 18, I hear that story. Grew up in, like, suburbs where, I skin my knees, I go to the doctor. And so I'm blown away, and I go, oh, my God, Dad, I had no idea. I'm so sorry, And he goes, what the fuck are you sorry for? And I said, well, that's really messed up that Grandpa did that. He goes, did you not listen to the story? The man saved my fucking arm. And from his perspective, it was this, like, heroic thing that his father did, whereas, like, if I had heard that, I'd be like, Dad just doesn't care if I live. And so it was one of the first things that got me into writing, because it's like you have this story, and everyone interprets it a different way. For my dad, it's this, like, heroic moment that he lionized his father, and for me, it's like, that's horrible. And so I think that's one of the things I like to play around with in the writing, is that I lay it out there, and I try not to put too much of myself in it so that you know, you read it and you're not getting really my attitude of like, I thought that this was messed up when my dad did this, or I thought this was, you know, unfortunate when this happened. It's just, I laid out there and everybody gets different perspectives. And it's funny, when I do the book signings, some people will come up to me and the one part they just love and they're like, oh, I'm going to, I use that with my kids all the time. And then another person will come and be like, that's so horrible. I can't believe that happened, you know? And so it's just kind of interesting to see. So, that was kind of what I wanted to say, and I don't know if any of you guys have any questions, or if not, I can just sort of sign some books, but I really appreciate you coming out, so I'll send you. Anybody have anything, any questions, anything at all? Sure.
I want to know if your dad has read
the books. Oh, yeah. My rule with anybody in my books is that, louder? The question was, this is for a podcast, so the question was if my dad's read my books. Anyone who is in my book that I'm in contact with, I have them read the chapter before it goes to my editor. Because the most important thing, I think, is to maintain the relationships that make up my life. Because who cares how successful you are if you have no one to share it with? You know? So, and generally I'm the guy who looks the worst in all these books, but paramount to everything was my relationship with my father, because it took a long time to get it to where it was, and I didn't want to screw it up. So, it was funny, when I finished Shit My Dad Says, I said, alright, I want you to read the book. And I came over, and first I emailed it to him. He's like, I'm not reading anything off a computer screen. I was like, alright. So then I printed it all out, like 200 pages or however long it is. I handed it to him, and then I go to walk away. He's like, where are you going? I'm like, I'm going to walk away. I don't know, going somewhere else. He's like, no, you're going to sit here next to me while I read the whole thing. Which, by the way, anyone who's ever written or made a movie or anything, the last thing you want is to be next to the person who is consuming the thing that you've just done. It's the worst, especially when it's supposed to be humorous. And if you're not here, like when my wife reads stuff, I have to just leave, because I'm like, why isn't she laughing? It's terrible. She hates it. You know, I drive myself crazy. But he's like, no. So I'm like, this is the first time he's read it, so I'm terrified he's going to be like, I didn't say this, or, you know, this didn't happen this way, or this and that, or I can't believe you thought this. But here's what happened. So he'll be reading something, and then I'll see him scribble a note furiously, but then he doesn't tell me what he's doing. He just keeps going to the end. And I'm thinking, oh, God, he's scribbling all these notes everywhere. This is going to be really bad. And then at the end he goes, all right. He's like, page 4. It's like, you said I hopped into the car? I go, yeah. He goes, when the fuck have you ever seen me hop into anything? I was like, all right, I'll just change it to get in. He's like, yeah, you will, or this book won't be published. I'm like, okay, done. And he'd be like, page 16, I've never combed my hair. I will brush it on occasion. And it was just little things like that. So he didn't really have a problem. I mean, one of the questions I get a lot of people would be like, well, how do you remember all these things? Like, you remember these conversations? For the most part, I don't remember details like that. What I'll do is I'll write a draft of something, and then I'll sit down with the people who are in it, and I'll say, all right, well, here's what I remember. And then they'll go, okay, well, here's what we remember. And I remember saying like this. And for my dad, I mean, some stuff of my dad, like, because he's very quotable, obviously, I remember clearly. But other things, I don't. And, you know, the flow of a conversation is important in writing. It has to feel real. And so a lot of what I'm doing is I'm remembering a conversation and then trying to get what he's saying correct and the flow of it correct. And then he looks it over, and if something feels like it doesn't sound like him, then he's like, get that out of there. I would never have said that, you know? He's not looking at it for, like, your enjoyment. He's looking at it because he doesn't want to be misrepresented, you know? So that's what I do. And stories where I'm, like, 10 or younger, those stories are borderline, like, dictated to me, you know? Like, I'll write my draft of it, and then my brothers and my parents will go through and be like, man, that didn't happen like that. It happened like this and this, that kind of stuff.
Well, actually, I was wondering, what was the order of things of how you because I used to follow you on Twitter.
My parents made love. No.
Oh, yeah. And I thought you were like the snotty-nosed kid, and I was like, damn, he's really funny as hell. But was it Twitter account?
That's good you made that change.
One day when I was on YouTube, I was like, damn, he's really a big kid. But who was the order of things? Was it Twitter account? Did you say to yourself, well, I got some really funny things I want to share that my father says? I mean, how did that happen?
So the order of sort of how everything happened with Shit My Dad Says was I was working at Maxim magazine in 2009. And I wasn't a big fan of the magazine, but I had a good job where I could kind of write whatever I wanted, and they were good to me. And one of the reasons why I took the job was so that I could live in the, I was doing long-distance relationship with my girlfriend. She was living in San Diego. I was living in L.A. And Maxim said, you can work from wherever you want. And things hadn't been going great in our relationship. It wasn't like we were fighting or stuff like that, but she had moved for grad school, and we just had sort of grown apart because we weren't around each other that much. And so because I am dumb, your first instinct was correct. I was like, you know what I'll do? I'll just show up at her apartment and be like, I'm moving in. Isn't this great? Which is the worst thing you could ever do. Like, any women in this audience right now, if someone did that, if your boyfriend did that to you, you would probably break up with him, which is what happened. She was like, what? Have you not been in this relationship for the last, like, 4 months? And so we broke up. And, we broke up, like, then. When I had bags in my hands. Like, I didn't even set them down. I didn't even unpack stuff. So I'm driving around San Diego, and I'm like, "Woof, where am I going to go? I don't even know where I'm going to live. Like, God, I'm such an idiot." Like, it was all hitting me at once. It was like one of those things where they're like, you know, you pull the tarp off the car, and you're like, there it is. But it was just how stupid I was. and so that's when I drove over to my dad's house and my dad and mom's house, he let me stay there. And so while I was staying there, he had just retired. He'd been in the Navy for a while, and then he was a doctor of nuclear medicine till he was like 65. He retired, and then he had most of his retirement money in Enron. And so when Enron went down, he had to go back to work. So he went back to work for 8 more years at 65. And he did till like he worked till he was like 73 or something around there, but he had just retired when I showed up at his door, a credit to him because he's a huge-hearted guy, and I hope that comes through in the books. But he has a crazy good moral compass, and he was like, yeah, of course you're my kid, you know, like don't stay super long, but but come in. And so that's when I started the Twitter feed, and that was in August of 2009, just at the start of August. And it hadn't really taken off. My girlfriend at the time, who we had been split up, let me go back. I moved in May. I didn't start the Twitter feed until August. My girlfriend and I had actually just decided to get back together, which is kind of where this book starts, but then it goes all the way back, as you know. We kind of got back together before Shit My Dad Says the Twitter feed had blown up. And then about a month later, it just exploded. And it was like, went from 0 followers. And then in 3 days, it went to like 100,000. And it was crazy. And it was just like every time I'd refresh it on the internet, it'd be like 500 new people. It was crazy. And I had already been doing screenwriting, and that had been my background in LA. I'd sold a movie that never got made, and I'd optioned another one that nothing ever happened with. But I had been making a little bit of money, and I had at least like representation in place and stuff like that. So then when I got approached to do a book, I remember because I didn't have a book agent. I knew nothing about publishing. And I just checked in at replies on Twitter to see who was like messaging me, and one of them was just like this, the first one, and one of the first ones I saw was an agent saying like, "Hey, do you want to have an interest in doing this as a book?" And so I emailed them back, and I was like, "Well, I haven't told my dad about this, so I got to check with that first." But I wrote this I said, you know, I said to the guy, I said, listen, I can write, you know, I've been writing for a while, and I think there's more to this book than just quotes. I'm not really interested in a quote book. And, you know, as anyone who is plucking something off the internet like that would be like, yeah, sure, you can write. Like, easy, buddy. Just take the funny things your dad say and put them in a book. So then when I gave him the book proposal, he was like, you know, this actually could be a book. And at the same time that went out, kind of like studios and networks saw it too, because it's pretty incestuous. And that was kind of when everything started happening. So I had a book deal by November, and I had sold it as a TV show by late November. And then we shot a pilot with William Shatner, who is crazy, but awesome. Let me say that too. Yeah, I could tell a couple funny Shatner stories. We shot out the pilot in late February, and then we found out we were picked up in mid-May, and we were on the air the next fall, which was lightning. It was as fast as that process can possibly happen. It was crazy. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. Can we get that on the mic? He doesn't think I'm a snotty nose kid anymore. Thank you. Sure.
I didn't think your series was that bad.
Yeah. Well, when I told him, he was like the Star Trek guy. And I was like, well, he's done more than that. He's done all this other stuff, and none of it my dad had ever heard of. And my dad was like, I think I should be played by James Earl Jones. I was like, but we're white. And the other people in the show we've already cast are white. He's like, that would be a more interesting show. And he might have been right. But you know what's funny is, so to be honest, he didn't really give a shit. But when I told Shatner, I was like, he's so honored. So he came to the pilot taping of the show. He's not into TV. He doesn't think it's cool. He doesn't think it's like a interesting job. He thinks it's like the moral decay of this world. So that's not true. He likes the show Breaking Bad. That is his favorite show. That's the only show he watches that's scripted. Everything else is like History Channel and Hitler documentaries and stuff like that. So anyway, I got him to come to the taping of the show, and he at the end, everybody was like, ah, it'd be great if he met Shatner and we got a picture. You in the middle and Shatner, and then your dad on the other side. And Shatner is very much like my dad. And he's, like, more hammy. Like, the only difference is he wants attention because he's an actor, you know, and he wants to be liked by an audience. It's, like, in their nature. And my dad doesn't want to be liked by anyone. He doesn't care because he doesn't want to have to like someone back. At the end of the show, they bring them up and... And Shatner has no interest in meeting my dad. And my dad has no interest in meeting Shatner. But everyone else has interest in them meeting each other. So Shatner comes up, and my dad comes up. And Shatner goes, hello, sir, and sticks out his hand. And my dad goes, hello, sir. And they shake hands and take a picture. And then Shatner walks away, and my dad walks away, right? But Shatner is on the set and knows where to go. My dad just walks into a corner. And he's such a prideful guy. He's acting like he belongs in this weird corner of the studio where no one else is. And I had to like go and get him and be like, what are you doing in the corner? Let's go. Like just facing the corner like he was having a timeout. It was really weird. That was when they met. And after that, he was like... Because my dad didn't really like the show. So he was like, well, you know, he's fine. You know? So that was kind of his thing. So, no. He thought he was fine. What else? All right. Well, thank you guys for coming. And I'll definitely sign some books. Yeah.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.